Hello. Welcome to the Roll Together podcast. Thank you for joining us for these podcast versions of our streamed shows from Twitch. You can always find our schedule of upcoming shows at twitch.tv/RollTogetherRPG/schedule. Please do leave a review, and we look forward to adventuring together. Hello, everyone, and welcome once again to Talk Together. Thank you for joining us once more, or for the first time if it's your first time, for an evening of talking about Dungeons and Dragons. I am, once again, David Shears, and I will be your host tonight. I have the very special privilege today of chatting to Chris Hislop, whom you can see me here.
Oh, no.
Chris? there's going to be a lot of that, I'm afraid.
We've
known each other for far too long.
I do get to a point with these things where I'll get a nice message from someone about a game I've just run, or like today I'll have a chat with another streamer who will say, oh, you're raiding out into us, you know, that's so kind of you. And
as ever, as humble as you are, lovely. For those that may never have seen anything Roll Together, but have just stumbled across this interview, tell us a little bit about yourself.
I'm the head of production at Roll Together, so I handle all of the producing aspects. You know, pass out jobs to other people, organize a lot of the sort of processes behind the scenes that make all the shows that you see on the channel. I don't have any kind of creative control, thank heavens. That is very much shared out amongst the company directors and DMs that we bring in. And I handle a lot of what I'd say is like the behind the scenes sort of minutiae work, like, you know, organizing teams of mods and organizing editing things and that sort of thing.
It's basically making sure that everything that needs to happen happens.
Yeah.
chat, forgive me. I have a bit of a frog in my throat this evening, so if you see me clearing my throat on occasion, that will be the reason why.
Or we could do the whole thing like this if you want, if it's easier.
Or yeah, we could just be Muppets for the entire interview, which would be fun for us.
I don't know,
probably not for everybody else.
And of course, most people will be aware of Chris from their place as a dungeon master on many streams previous, current, and presumably also to come. That's basic.
I am not the only DM that works with Roll Together. I think I do a lot of stuff with Roll Together because I've been doing it for a very long time. Because I did it beforehand when we were still Adventurers Wanted, and then I started when we were only one show a week. I was doing quite a lot of them, so I did sort of gain that position. But that's not all I do. It's not my only thing. But I've been DMing longer than I've been playing, certainly.
Many, many hats. Mm. I remember you were the very first DM that I had the privilege to encounter. And it was a nice, it was an excellent entry into the hobby. But
I mean,
before...
mate, we'll get to questions in a second, but just to be clear, that game, the game that you came in on, was a mad experiment that went super, super well in some ways and was an utter disaster in others. But I wouldn't say it was indicative of the hobby as a whole. A game with, how many players were there? 25?
Yeah, I mean, you have to understand, that's what I thought D&D was when I started playing. I thought it was just 17 people in a room swapping in and out.
It was so much fun, but it was such a high concept and such a big... There are times when I've loved big concept gaming and trying new things, but there's nothing like a group of 4 to 5 to maybe even 6 people sat around a table. Which it took a while for us to play in that context. But
that has subsequently become the norm for me. Yes, and it is a lot less hectic. But there were definitely some high points in the
that campaign.
Which we may now that we've teased it, I feel like we'll have to touch on at least one or two points at some point.
Easily done, no problem.
But to persevere with the introduction, because absolutely. Let's get out of the way before we can get into the interesting part of this whole extravaganza. Tonight we are going through some enticing questions and adventurous anecdotes. What questions you ask? Well, as we are not live on this occasion, the dice once again decide. Before we kick off, this stream will run for approximately an hour. We are delighted to be sponsored by Hero Forge Ultra Pro and Elderwood Academy. Thank you very much for my hex chest. I love it. And supported by D&D Beyond, Warriors of Waterdeep, and Level Up Dice. We are Roll Together RPG on all social media, and a massive thank you once again to our D20 Club on Patreon. Our shows are available as podcasts. Just search Roll Together RPG on your favorite podcasting app. And if you want to skip ahead from the preamble, feel free. Get into the nitty and the gritty.
I mean, sometimes it's 5 minutes, sometimes it's 20. It depends a bit on who's DMing and what kind of mood they're in. If it's me, it'll be at least 20 minutes. Probably a lot of ramble.
It's also whether the cast needs to sort of defenestrate themselves from whatever traumas they've been experiencing.
Well, I mean, this isn't a question, but I think it's worth pointing out that when I first started doing live streaming like this, and when it became recorded streaming and all the rest of it, we talked about how long the preamble should be, because there are some streamers out there who just dive straight in, where you turn on, there's maybe 30 seconds, and then it's the show. And there's others, most notably Critical Role, who take their time, who do ads, who, you know, talk about how they're feeling. And to a certain extent, I always found that more interesting. Mm. Not more interesting than the show, but it gave you a real flavor of these humans. And it gave you a real flavor of when the humans stopped and the characters started, so that during gameplay, the interaction between the person and the character felt more pronounced. But that's also a very big theory way of saying we have a lot of sponsors. How else are we supposed to get them in?
I mean, yeah, the list is as long as the list is, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's great. We're very lucky. We were very lucky very early on that we managed to pick up a couple of supporters when we were still Adventurers Wanted. And when we were just reaching out, just going, hey, who's interested? What can we get? And the feedback was very positive, and we've built on nice, decent-sized audiences and good feedback and good vibes. And then from there, it's just turned into this lovely, we'd like to support you, like no better exemplified than the current Warriors of Waterdeep game, which started off as a concept that I spoke to the brand manager about, God, months ago, in a completely different job, different hat on even. And then we sort of retouched base again and went, that was a good idea, we should do something with that. And it just sort of rolled from there. Yeah.
Absolutely. I have been really, really enjoying the build up to Warriors of Waterdeep, having heard hints, mere hints of what was on the horizon.
Well, you will hear plenty of hints because you're dating one of the players.
Hints, mere hints, and then finding out, what was going on, and seeing wigs and characters and this whole thing together.
It's really nice in that we have, to a certain extent, we've been given a huge amount of leeway. How it's not like they came to us and said, here's what we want, it has to be this. They came to us and said, how would you put our game, you know, in some kind of stream format? So there was a lot of conversation around, do we play existing characters? If we're playing existing characters, will the fan base hate us for making them all sound British? You know, do we want to take what is basically a hack and slash directional game, go into this room, fight these monsters, go on to the next room? Will people want characterization and storytelling around that, particularly will they want characterization of these characters that are currently quite blank slates? There's a lot of sort of fluff and flavor around them, but you don't get a lot of personality, they're not voiced. So there was a lot of question around that, how many of the characters are licensed already. Like, it was a huge number of variables to throw in there, but it's been that lovely combination of we have an idea and then Ludia says that's really great, or they have an idea and we say that's really great, and then we just bounce off each other. It's been really, 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 really fun, and the finished product is super cool. I'm very proud of it.
Well, I was popping in and out of chat, and I've been seeing some really positive reactions to it, which I'm not surprised by, to be honest. You've got a wonderful whole creative team there, great cast,
and very good people, really, really good team.
And I'm looking forward to seeing how it plays out. I've deliberately said I don't want any spoilers. I don't want any hints of
the game. You know what happens. We haven't veered too heavily away from that. At least not yet.
I win and get loads of good gear, right? That's what happens when I play the game.
Well, it was more that there is a plot to Warriors. There is a plot to what's going on. And there's a lot of like, this happens, then that happens, sort of intersectionality between the different bits of the plot. And that's really cool. But it is very much, the plot is designed to be a vehicle to drive you playing more of the game and getting through the game, which is, you know, the point of a game. I understand that. So I have sort of, tied together some pieces, circled some, tied together some circles. Was it, there's a nice line for that. Squared some circles.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's it. Just to make sure that everything hangs together a bit better as a sort of narrative. But generally speaking, we are people who love the game should recognize moments and even scenes from the game that they love that we have actually tried to recreate with some D&D tweaks, because it's not, it doesn't use exact D&D rules. So we've...
And presumably new people who are new to the game, there's enough character story content there to engage them as well.
It's, I mean, if you like an actual play stream, it's an actual play stream. We're not doing anything too clever. Like, we're not pushing the boat out too far. But it's an actual play stream that if you like the game, you will recognize the pieces of. And it's hopefully an actual play stream that if you don't recognize the pieces of, you could go, oh, that looks like fun, and tap into it and maybe download the game, because it's free to download. So,
yeah. Absolutely. I've been playing it a lot lately.
I know, we're in the same league.
Yeah, guilds forever. As soon as you say square some circles, it just made me think like, it's time for WrestleMania in the squared circle. But that's a flashback to my youth.
A lot of D&D people seem to be really into their wrestling. It's never been something I've been that engaged with. I don't mean in a negative way. I have no opinion on it. I don't know anything about it. I can see how the appeal for theatre people is there, because it is all performance, obviously.
Oh, yeah.
And I can see how the appeal is there for D&D people, because it is sort of, it is a role play. It is a performative role play, which is basically what D&D is. So, well, what D&D is for some people, for us and our group of friends most specifically, but for a lot of people, I would say. And I can see how that ties in with wrestling quite nicely. There was an interview The Rock gave where he was talking about being a wrestler and said, look, it's of course, you have this physique, you spend a lot of time looking the part and a lot of time working towards looking the part, but if you don't have a good character, if you don't have a good storyline, if the producers of the shows are not building into your storyline and what it does for your character, you won't last very long. So I can totally see how that analogy fits in with a bunch of other jobs that I've done in the past. So I can see it makes sense to me.
I can also see it from some of the conversations that I've had with people on this show, mainly around how people feel about fudging roles. An element of, and forgive me, I'm gonna mispronounce it, so anyone that's a wrestling fan, forgive me, but I've only ever seen it spelled. It's like kayfabe, which is this. It's a word that it basically refers to the theatrical reality of wrestling. Right. So the fact that everybody knows it's fake, but everybody acts as if it's true.
Interesting. Okay.
In order to engage with that sort of story narrative. And having run the gauntlet from people who hate fudging roles to people who are like, well, I'll do it for reasons.
Well, I know this is a dice question that may come up later, but sort of I'm answering it now. I think fudging roles is a particularly interesting conversation, because it really says something about the person and how they feel about how it relates to the game, because for some people, the roles are sacrosanct.
Yeah.
And I don't think those people are wrong. The idea that the roles change what is happening and you have to go with them because that is the way the dice have fallen is a really nice thing to hold on to, and gives you a sense of stability in something that can be very, you know, we're all generating an imaginative image concept thing together. Having some stability in that, I can totally see as a viable, this is what makes me click together. And I know players who go, but that role feels bad for the situation, or that role doesn't fit into my idea of what was supposed to happen. And, well, from a DMing perspective, you always fudge roles. And I don't mean that in a way like every single role can be or should be fudged, not at all. I think it's sometimes very important to roll the dice openly, let the players see what's happening. But I think there's more gained from a momentary, as a DM, going, if I, for example, give the monster 10 more hit points at this point, will this extra round or turn that comes after it be really important or cool? Maybe, if you have a strong feeling that might be the case, do it. That's, you're in charge of the table, you're helping the players tell that story. There's nothing wrong with cooking the books slightly to make sure that everyone either has as much fun as they possibly can, or all of the people watching what you're doing, if you're doing a live stream, for example, get the payoff that they want. Especially with what we do with 12 episode arcs or 4 episode arcs, we are very constrained in terms of time. I have no problem with going, it's only 12 episodes, if I don't do this now it'll never happen kind of thinking. Like it makes sense to me that there is a certain amount of fudging that comes with all of that, that certainly from the DM side of the table is almost a necessity. From the player side, I have a slightly different attitude. I think that fudging happens for reasons. Like, there will be players who go, I need this moment to land because I'm extremely personally invested. I need this moment to land because otherwise I will be upset about it. Or I want to fail in this because I don't actually want my character to do this, but I've made a roleplay choice and I don't want to say, stop everyone, I've made an error, let's do that scene again. Like, that happens, of course it does. I think it's perfectly valid within that to see the dice as a tool, as an aid, and sometimes to go, no, that's not how I want this to go. And I don't think it's anyone's job to police it, even if it's a stranger way of thinking about it. If someone is fudging rules or not is entirely their call. And we don't need to know. We will never know unless they tell us. And why would you tell us? There's no need, you know?
Yeah. I guess it's that line where player meets performer.
Mm.
You know, the former being effectively bound by rules and the latter being... bound by serving the story and serving the narrative that the group collectively wants to tell.
Yeah.
There's no right or wrong answer to it. I personally prefer not to. I prefer to sort of live or die by the dice.
Mm.
But that's not to say there would never come a situation where I might feel differently because of that. What I wanted to do in that precise moment.
Okay. But yes, Bart, I will give you two examples from games that we played in together as really good examples here of where fudging can be problematic and where fudging actually makes something work. So fudging can be problematic. That first game we played in, naming no names, obviously, we had a player that you and I are both fully aware fudged nearly every single role that he made because he wanted to make sure that his character won arguments. And... that was clearly a problem because the rest of the group was going, well, there's no point doing anything with that player where it's a roll-off or where we have any inter-character conflict because they will just go, I roll a persuasion check, oh, look, it's a 25. And we all got so aware of that so much that playing became problematic and became difficult. And, you know, we had to sort of stop games to talk about it because it was clearly a problem. That's a good example of where fudging for yourself because you need something to happen has gone too far. The whole game has changed. It is no longer a game of roles and chance. It is a game of, well, I need this to happen, otherwise my day is ruined.
It's an I win button.
Exactly. It became that, and that is obviously a problem. Like, that's the kind of thing where fudging is clearly an issue and where it needs to be talked about. But then again, in the home game that I run with you, where you play a hobgoblin... what are you? A bladesinger. You're a hobgoblin bladesinger.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A hobgoblin bladesinging nightmare, yes.
Oh, no, the character's amazing. You've made something that is, frankly, nigh on unkillable. And because of rules, things, and things like that, it's a very power-played character, but... you've not power played a character and gone, there are no reasons for this. You found good reasoning and storytelling behind it. And in that good reasoning and storytelling, you decided you were part of an order. So I wanted to make sure you had to face off with someone in your own order to show you the engagement factor of how powerful your character is. And we had a basically one-on-one duel.
That was epic, yeah.
It was amazing. But Dave, I don't think I fudged any in that. And I don't think you did either.
No.
But I would have done if I was looking like I was going to win. Because it would have been a terrible story point. Your party is currently getting everyone on side to fight in a huge war. And this, frankly, arsehole, because I played it as one, challenged you to a one-on-one duel to say, I think you've made the wrong choice here. And I wanted it to be difficult. I wanted to showcase how great bladesingers are when fighting each other as well. It was so cool. Spells and swords thrown down. It was a proper duel in old-school D&D style. But if he had won, it would have turned the entire campaign on its head for little to no reason.
Mm.
And I wanted to show challenge, and I wanted to show a duel, and I wanted to show... it came down to the wire. It was down to a dice roll either way. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But frankly, if it had come down to it of a killing blow being struck at the wrong moment, I would have fudged it. That's a bad story. And I know that's a bad story. You would have had a lousy tie. The rest of the party would have been upset because their champion didn't win. Why would I do that?
I guess that's that classic point, isn't it? That it should never be about the DM versus the players.
No, absolutely not. Like, okay, we're about to go into a big thing in Gloomfalls, and no spoilers, I promise. But you're about to face off against a ridiculous monster. And it is ridiculous. I have made it ridiculous because balancing the CR for the Gloomfalls party has been... I mean, you'll see in watching it, some combats are super tense and the CR's right and everyone's like, oh God, we're all really close to the edge here. And some of them, you just you steamroller through them. I put in all these things at a super high power. This week's fight, the High Priest of Mask, CR22, and 10 underlings, and your vampire nemesis, who was going to stay out of it largely because they had other motives, as you saw. But the fact that you have a wizard who can counterspell and only took one round meant that I couldn't do anything. I tried to cast two spells and both were counterspelled, so that was it. That was the end of the setup.
I mean, I genuinely didn't think we had a bad roll in that entire combat.
No, you didn't, but that's great. I have no... I think as storytelling devices, I like that you all went, is this it? Really? Is wow, okay. This clearly wasn't the big bad, but it's been built up to be like the big bad, and then, of course, the reveal at the end of the episode.
Judging by what's apparently to come, it might be just as well.
Well, yeah. I mean, I had various versions of that encounter where it taxed you completely, and then there was a longer break until the next bit of that encounter kicked in. I had versions where all sorts of different things, but I'd never want you all to lose. I want you all to win against adversity. That's the point.
It's finding that level, which I think is something that I would struggle initially to find as a DM, between putting a genuine challenge in front of a party and also being on their side and rooting for them to win, and just knowing where to plant the flag on that. I guess it just takes experience, right?
As a system, well, I mean, it takes experience, yes, but also I think as a system, it is very difficult in D&D terms to know which monsters are going to actually be quite fun for the party and which are going to be terrible. Well, an easy one. It came up in a recent game. I had an encounter where the party were fighting an assassin. And I had everything set up for the assassin, and I knew it was going to be like, you know, where's the rogue gone? Where have they gone? Oh, they hit as a bonus action. Oh, it's so annoying. And I thought that would be fun. It wasn't. The players just couldn't find the character. They kept sneaking around going, where is this person? It became a lot of roles and not quite sure what's going on. And that is something that would work very, very well if that was a player character. Yeah. But on the other side of the fence, didn't work at all. It was annoying. It was frustrating. Like, you'll notice that very few D&D monsters have healing abilities.
Yeah, true.
Because it's boring. What does the big bad do on its route? Heals itself. Oh, so we've got to do all that again. Yep.
Yeah, it just becomes a war of attrition.
It becomes a slog. And no one really wants a slog. They want things that change and moments that develop. And giving
them... arguably 4th edition.
Well, 4th... No. I'm not going to be too hard on 4th edition. I mean, I absolutely fucking hate 4th edition, but I'm not going to be too hard on it because that's personal taste over pure factual analysis. They took 3rd edition, which was... I mean, it's where I started. It is my favourite. But it's also... I didn't play much 3rd edition, and I'm glad I didn't, because the complexity of 3rd edition was just insane. There was they came out with various books, specialist books about the different classes, and the one Fighters and Monks was called Sword and Fist. And I will never forget this book, because one of the appendices was a duel, and it described that duel, not just this is how the duel happens, but what the DM and players say, and therefore what actions you take. It was 9 pages long, Dave. It was 9 pages long, and 9/10 of it was, right, I jump on the table, which means I then use my flat-footed AC, which means I can run over there, blah, 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 blah. And it wasn't wrong. It was how 3rd edition was designed to be played, extremely complex. But it did mean that the curve to access was ridiculous. And the fact that you could multi-class most classes together, and then there were prestige classes on top of that, and anything that came out in a magazine or a book was automatically game legal because of the OGL. Open gaming license. You created this monster, which was gorgeous, and what Pathfinder became after that. The 4th was a real attempt to streamline, and they streamlined too far. 5th is a really good example of how you can complexify up, but not too far. But it's still very, very complicated, especially when you look at things like CR balancing, which is where we started this conversation off. Easy one. There's a creature called a Nilbog. It's goblin backwards. It's a CR1, I think? 1.5? It's nothing. It has very few hit points. However, one of its main abilities is it can push all damage. It can ignore some damage. It can push it to another creature over there. Technically, it moves to another goblin host every time it dies because it's a goblin spirit. I put one in a campaign once and it was the most annoying thing the players ever faced, and it took them 4 rounds to go, we're walking away. We are walking away, it's not worth it. And I went, it's a CR 1.5. They're level 3 and it's a CR 1.5 and they're giving up. that is clearly not statted correctly when you think about CR, but in terms of the hit points and how much damage it does, it's statted correctly. So what does that mean? It means the only way you can really gauge the challenge of a particular creature is by running it. So you've got to either DM a lot or read everything you can find. There's lots of great resources. The Monsters Know, KNOW, is possibly my favorite for that, because that is a blog written by a, well, it's a book now, written by a DM who goes, this is how this monster works. And there are abilities and subsets which you read and go, I'm thinking of how that works. And you look at it again and go, nope, but no idea that did that. That's why it does that. Cool.
Like a tactical manual.
Well, if you think of the complexity of something like a beholder, great example. Beholders can shoot eye rays. They shoot a certain number on their turn. Don't ask me how many, I can't remember. I'd look it up. And then they can shoot others as legendary actions. So a beholder's shooting somewhere between 5 and 6 eye rays a turn, I think. Mm-hmm. And the eye rays are all super powerful. You roll a dice to see which one you attack with, but of course DMs can fudge. And there's some that are almost insta-perma-death, and there are some that are sort of quirky and change the nature of the combat. That all sounds great. The beholder's central eye is an anti-magic cone, which means the beams can't enter it.
Huh.
So, how does one DM that? Does the big... do you just close the central eye because you can't hit anything if you're looking at it? At what point in your turn do you change where you're looking? Can you change your look? Are you looking out of turn, or is it just a cone that moves to a certain point and at the end of your turn, that's where it is? Do you want to use the cone to point at a wizard over there and the eye beams to shoot at the fighters over there? The tactical complexity of that for a new DM, I can't imagine. Whereas reading a guide or running a few of them and going, that's how this is probably going to work, clarifies that process. Absolutely.
It's the degrees of DM-ship and knowledge and understanding.
Yeah.
It's like getting different coloured belts as you move further up how monsters work.
There is this... I think it's a myth. This myth that DMing is... I don't think that you look at an expert DM and go, ooh, they have mastered the craft. No, not at all. Because everyone's different. So everyone's got different vibes and different ideas of how things are supposed to work anyway. It's like... I mean, the analogy I always give is like theatre directing, because famously theatre directing, how do you want a theatre director? You find actors dumb enough to let them direct you. Like, that's... How do you become a DM? You find players dumb enough to let you DM them, and then you get better. I don't think there should be like a hierarchy of DMs. That's a terrible idea.
If there was, I know where I would be on it, but I've got some books to read now. I'm going to learn some things.
Mate, don't look at it that way. Don't. It's some of the most enjoyable games I've had are with DMs who are not like, you know, famous internet DMs. Some of my favorite moments are from DMs who I would say have other things where I go, not fantastic, but that moment was amazing. You know, that's the point.
I'm really looking forward to trying it. I'm just one of those obsessional people that feels like I want to know everything about everything, and that's often my downfall.
I mean, absolutely can't.
There was a time when I tried reading the Player's Handbook cover to cover, and I gave up roundabout how climbing works.
I mean,
on the basis that cross that bridge.
Well, there's also the most important thing in a DM's arsenal, which we've talked about before. This idea that the rules are there and therefore you have to follow them all to the letter. No, you don't. And frankly, if you do, it's going to be a very boring game. If a player goes, can I do this? Chances are they want you to say yes. And unless it absolutely screws with the whole thing, everything that you're doing, probably best to say yes, because that will make them have more fun. And it means you encourage, if you yes and every player thought or decision or choice, you are giving them more tools to keep doing that, to keep yes anding new ideas. Like a live game I ran, one of the players went, can I play a Warforged who makes ice creams? Well, yeah, of course you can. You are a Warforged ice cream maker. And that then became, oh, here's my ice cream homunculus. And that then became, it became all sorts of stuff. It just developed. And then their grand plan for getting into a prison was to give them poisoned ice creams. It worked. Like, because the player had this little concept idea, was given all of this, yes, do more. This is lovely. And it just built and built and built and built. The homunculus had... What's the Pokemon called that is an ice cream cone? Do you remember?
Gosh, no. Chat will provide the answer, probably, I'm sure.
But I had this lovely little... I just had to voice them. So it was just us the whole time. Oh, no! But that wouldn't have come out unless the player had gone, here's my ice cream homunculus.
I think absolutely, like being able to enable that player creativity. I mean, it's at the heart of improv for sure.
Yeah.
Sometimes with an element of caution. I mean, speaking for myself, there's no phrase that can ever be uttered by a DM that gives one more pause for thought than you sure?
Well, are you sure means, I mean, I'm sure you've gathered this from me over the years. When I say, are you sure? What I'm normally saying is that's going to kill you. And...
Got a new character sheet there, have you? Just in case something happens?
I do feel semi-beholden to keep the world cogent, cohesive. So if jumping into some lava because you think it's a good place to hide and you're not in any way resistant to fire is your idea, I am going to say, are you sure? Because you might... There's also the are you sure works very well as the I as a person think that this would be a good thing to do. Are you sure D&D rules do not replicate the real world? The classic being grapple checks.
Yeah. And jumping.
Oh, God.
I freeze midway through the air for 6 seconds, waiting for everyone else to go.
You're not supposed to. In D&D rules, if a character jumps into the air, they have to land before the end of their turn. Otherwise, the whole thing is silly, which is why in a turn, you can run 30 feet, but you can fall 500. Like, that's all built into the rule system. But it is janky. Like, famously, in D&D rules terms, a 5 foot square is also 5 foot across diagonally.
Yeah, it has to be.
Because
world. I've seen so many debates around diagonals, and it's just like, yeah. And why? Verticals as well, to be fair. It's just like, yeah,
why
make
kill
it
yourself?
Simple.
Just when the character player goes, can I do this? Say yes.
I remember that next time I'm hiding in some lava.
Don't always say yes, especially with players like Dave.
Like, just going back to what we talked about, seemingly.
I'm
like
most noted by, can I have the key, Chris? I want the key from the super powerful Doctor Who analog. Can I have the key?
Yeah,
I mean, it was always going to be a no.
Yeah. I mean, sure, but the character would have done it. Key.
Yeah, I don't fault you as a player, and I actually approve you as a player going, can I roll for this? And the DM going, nah, mate. And you going, I'm using a divine intervention. Because that is, I mean, to my mind, that is what things like divine intervention are for. Like, can I use divine intervention to fix this entire problem, i.e. avoid a bunch of difficult things that have happened in game? Yeah. Can I use divine intervention to countermand something you said could not happen, DM? Yeah, of course you can. That's what it's there for.
To be honest, I probably would have fudged that if I'd actually rolled for it.
And I wouldn't have faulted at you either.
Like, it's not the Aldrin show, everybody. Here's my key. Let's just spend the last few sessions traveling around the world in space and time. Yeah, maybe not so much.
We've got a story to tell, wouldn't it?
Yeah, ever so slightly. Mm. So I was wondering then, because I know we don't often go into session zero stuff with chat and things, but one of the things that came up before we started this campaign was how. So, for the lack of a better way of describing it, I would call social PvP works.
Yes.
So, for example, like you were saying before in the Frontier game with the masses and masses of people, and the fact that it became an issue there, essentially that you can roll and then suddenly you can never ever believe what you believe ever again because someone's just massively persuading you.
Exactly.
Was that partially in your mind when you were thinking about sort of dealing with social disputes and social... interactions in a more organic and somewhat more realistic way, I guess, less mechanics and more how characters actually interact as their characters?
Well, there's a difficult problem with charisma checks, because if your character is very charismatic and you are who you are and you have the ability to roll a dice to make people believe you, then what does it matter if you're talking to another player and they say, I don't believe you, and you go, well, I roll this dice, and now you do. It's a very difficult area because, for example, there are classes that are based around the idea of charisma. Obviously, bards, warlocks, and sorcerers are defined around it because it's their spellcasting ability. But you've also got mastermind rogues, You've also got, well, I'm thinking permutations of bard now, like glamour bards and so on, where it is a huge part of what they do.
Overpowered priests.
Overpowered priests, yeah, yeah. I don't think your charisma's the problem, mate. like, there's a problem with Aldrin. That was badly phrased. No, nothing. He's a fantastic character.
David Shears, his charisma was not the problem.
No, I don't have a problem with charisma-based roles. I think against other party members is extremely difficult because...
Yeah.
I mean, you get into difficult words around social pressure and gaslighting when it comes to conversations like that. I'm telling you this. You now believe it to be true. Yeah, but I don't, and now I have to play that I do. I think there's a place for social PvP, and I think a lot of the place for social PvP comes down to you and the other player having an understanding about how it's going to go. Not the end result, necessarily, but... For example, we have players in Gloomfalls where I would say if they, as a player, don't believe something, their character can't. They just won't be comfortable in it. They won't like it. And that is entirely valid. If that's their experience, that is their experience. In the same vein, we have players in other games in Gloomfalls as well who will go, my character doesn't know that, so I don't know that. And I don't think either is right or wrong. It depends a bit on the player and how they like to play. And that...
I guess as long as everybody's on the same page in terms of interacting with each other, that's it, right?
As you said, this is what Session Zeros are for. And I mean, it's not entirely what they're for, but we do Session Zeros before every campaign of more than a one-shot. And it's intentional, and it's important, because Session Zeros are a place to talk about what you don't want to happen, as a DM and as a player, very important. Session Zeros are also about saying what you do want to happen. So, for example, in a session zero, you might go, I'm not going to be very good with social PvP. If someone rolls a persuasion check on my character and I don't agree with them, I'm going to ignore that dice roll and play how I want to. And if you as a player know that player is going to feel that way, it means that if you are thinking of engaging in social PvP, you know which players to steer it towards, which also means you start looking at the plot points where you're going to steer into that. The only problem then arises is when things get super stressful and tense, which they do in games because there's big battles, big combats, things really matter to people. And then it's about, I think there's a gentleness and a deftness of touch with this sort of thing, of knowing when it is right to use and when it is absolutely not right to use. I suppose, I mean, the example we gave earlier of that player is that it should be a scalpel. If you particularly want to play a character with high social skills, who gets their way in specific things, choose what those specific things are, check in with the other players about those specifics and go, I want this to be a thing I can do. Will you be okay with that? And then you have an agreement. And you also need the ability then to step down from it. The player goes, I agree to that, but I don't want to today. That also needs to be part of that agreement. In the same vein, if you're playing in a party with someone who is a social PvP player who is playing that level of engagement with each other and you don't want to play that, just say it from the top.
Yeah,
I'm not going to enjoy this, so I'm not going to take part in it. If it means I don't take part in certain scenes, that's fine, because if your character tries to pull the wool over my eyes and I know that you're doing that, I am just going to ignore the dice.
I guess that feeds into sort of how you feel about another one of the dice questions. We might get through this without rolling any. sorry, chat. Enjoy your emotes. They're completely useless today.
I imagine they're all plugging roll that dice really hard, and we're just not.
It's because we know each other too well, mate, honestly.
That's true.
In terms of like the wider, like, I kind of almost want to ask you, just because I'm a gossip hound, like what the worst instance of PvP that you've ever seen is, like how being done wrong.
I can't give specifics for obvious reasons, but I have experienced a PvP encounter where two players, one was playing their character very performatively, had a very sort of big drive in how they wanted that character to be performed and what they believed their character believed and thought and went with, and had very strong opinions about that character and their personality and their drive, and was also quite sacrosanct to dice rolls. If this role happens, I will do it this way. Playing with a player who very clearly was there to have a bit more fun, was there to, poke at things, enjoy that kind of social repartee, playing a charisma-based character, obviously. And they got into a really quite nasty argument, which, it was a stream, so we could all see it. the problem was you could see the one player going, I have to go along with this because that is the diktat I have set myself for how I play this character, but I am raging. And you had the other player who didn't realize how pissed off the other player was, just poking more and more because that was what they did. And these two play styles just clashed. And there was about half an hour of, I think, everyone watching it just going, oh no,
he's going to explode. He's literally going to explode.
And the player just, in the end, snapping at the other one quite rudely and storming out. Wow. And it was a live stream, so they kept going. And the player came back and apologized, not on air, obviously. Yeah, but and if anything, I think the whole point of that, the bow that ties that one in, he came back, he sat down, they kept playing, it was fine, didn't happen again. Huh? So I presume that, and it also that stands as a good point to this sort of conversation. If you get it wrong, don't think that it's all over. Chances are that bridges can be healed, that conversations can be had after the fact. If it's in a live streamed format, that's obviously very difficult because the camera's on. But there are many, many ways to go. We need to do that again, or we need to try that again. I've never actually re-recorded something that we've done for Roll Together or for when I was still at Adventurers because we didn't like the way something went. There are times where we've sort of jump-started someone's turn and gone, hang on, we've got the battlefield confused, let's start that turn again, or something along those lines, but never like a really important emotional scene, let's do that again because we screwed it up. No.
Yeah, there's a very good reason, Chris, why I've never played a charisma-based character, because I feel like I have it in me to piss people off to the extent.
Okay. Now, here is something that you say about yourself quite a lot, and I disagree with fundamentally, and also something that people think about D&D that I also want to nip in the bud quite early on in that conversation. There is no wrong way to play a character, and there is no wrong person to play a character. If someone wants to play something that they think they would be good at and that they would enjoy, they absolutely should. There is no question about that. In a session zero, if you are worried about stuff, bring to the fore. I'm worried this character might be impossible to deal with, or this character might be an arsehole, blah, 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 blah. This is what session zeros are for. And if players don't want it, they will tell you, and then you can ameliorate what you're doing, or you've set it up so that during the stream or during the game or during the, you know, social interaction you have 4 weeks later, someone has the ability to go, remember that thing you said you were going to do? I really don't like it. And then either you go, well, that ruins how I want to play the character, so can we kill them off and bring in a new one? Happens. Yeah. Or you go, okay, I'll change them, I'll tweak them, so it's you know, we're all in a party together and it's more fun for all of us, and then the balance is struck better.
I hear what you're saying, and I agree with you to a large extent. Ooh. I think knowing myself personally, sometimes it helps me to play, and this is probably the reason I do so much work on characters in advance, it helps me to play a structured role because it encourages me to stay focused within that role. Like if I was playing a bard, for example, I would find it very hard to resist the urge to just pick up that guitar and shred a solo for 8 minutes, which is no fun for anyone apart from me.
Yes, but that's why you have a DM.
Yeah, that's true. And also, you shred for 8 seconds.
If you pick up a guitar and start shredding and it's a nice song, like I have games where people play bards who can actually play instruments, and it's gorgeous when they do, because then they'll actually play a song. And it's lovely to have at the table. It's a lovely little thing to add in. Ooh. I sort of try and steer them towards, as you are playing, so-and-so enters the pub. Like, you know, there's so many ways to take that. And it's not a bad thing to have people who are excited and vivacious and enthusiastic about their talents or their gifts or what they want to show off or anything like that. That's part of it. Like, you will note most of the characters I play when I, in the rare blessed instances where I get a chance to play a character and not DM the world, they often have silly voices. Why? I love silly voices. I love them so much.
I haven't seen you play a character in a game that you weren't also DMing. I'm hoping I get the chance to do so at some point.
I've done two one-shots. I did Red's one-shot last season, and I did Emma's one-shot last season as well.
So there's footage out there. There's evidence that it happens.
Yeah, absolutely. And in one, I absolutely annihilated Evie in one hit because it was a PvP game. And in the other, I was a centipede with a Muppet voice.
There have been some calls for a Battle Royale one-shot.
I mean... Yeah, remember what I was saying about rogues not being fun to play against? Yeah. Times a million. Battle royales are great, great fun if you go in going, my character's probably going to die real early because the wizard's got disintegrate. You know? Like, Critical Role did a battle royale for the end of the last campaign, and they just went, hey, cool, so the druid's going to win. They weren't wrong. Of course the druid won. At level 20, you can wild shape indefinitely. You have indefinite, yeah. You have infinite hit points on your turn.
That would do it. I mean, there is a bit of power creep, I think, between different classes over the levels, by and large, but I guess there's a reason why most D&D games aren't battle royales, right?
Sure. I also think that there's a... For example, I mean, I don't play that often, but when I do, I like to play druids. And it's not... I don't turn around and say, this is why there's a particular, like, I'm a nature person, or, oh, in my heart, I'm such a druid. No, kill plants. Kidding me? No. I like classes where you have a huge amount of choice that defines what you do and how you do it. And I like classes that take, I like subclasses in particular, that take class abilities and change them.
Yeah.
And the way that Wizards have done the druid wild shape subclass changes is sublime. You have some classes like the Wildfire Druid and the Stars Druid now, and Circle of the Moon, obviously, that redefine what wild shaping means. And then you have other parts of the other classes. Clerics are very good at this too. Changing Channel Divinities to be this smorgasbord of options really changes who that character is and how they function. And classes with those subclass changes are really, really valuable and fun and interesting and different, and you can play them 1,000 times and always play something different. Mm. Whereas then if you take something like a rogue or a fighter, I don't mean this harshly, I think they're both well-designed classes, but as a rogue, your job is to find the best way to sneak attack and do it ad infinitum. That is your job. You can be a face rogue, a social rogue, a whatever rogue. There are loads of different options of that, but in the end, your role is that. Mm. As a fighter, primarily you're going to be a tank. You will be standing at the front taking hits. That's just, you have a high hit point count. You probably have a very, very high AC, and you probably are doing multiple hits. But then in fighters, the battle master gives you that sense as well of that variance. Yeah. I'm doing this turn and this that turn. Like, playing a fighter taught me about reaction economy, something I as a player would never have thought about or considered until I was playing a thing that had three different reaction abilities. Mm. Depending on the situation, could either be massive overkill on an enemy or save a party member or what else. But yeah, with druids, the big thing that changes in, particularly in wild shaping, is just the multifariousness option.
Yeah.
All the different things you can turn into, learning how all of them work, how their hit point maxes change, how if you are a multi-class monk or a multi-class barbarian, you can get different things out of all of those as well. That's gorgeous. Like, there's very few classes that take the entire game system and go, let's see what happens now. And druids are always do that for me. And druids are also, because like clerics, you can swap out spells, you do have the ability over the course of a long rest to go from being I am blasty force of nature to I am the party healer for this combat, depending on what you're facing. So again, you can be extremely you can really vary up what you do and how you do it every day, which is super cool.
A lot more synergistic for sure.
Yeah, and I do find that when I play, I often want to know who everyone else is playing so I can fit in. Yeah. Like if someone else is playing, and it isn't necessarily a class, it's a party role. If someone's playing a tank, you don't need two tanks in a party. But if someone's playing a tank and I want to also play a kind of like combat character, would playing a rogue and being more of the last cannon sniper in sniper out role be better? Do we need a ranged weapon person? All of these things. If someone's playing a cleric healer and I go, do you want to heal all the time? And they go, yeah, I probably wouldn't play a druid because part of the druid role is I can be healer if you don't want to be. But if someone's going, my job is to be life cleric healer and heal everyone and it's all fine, you go, then I'll go over there and play a sorcerer or a wizard or whatever. Like,
yeah, I seem to remember the last time I was in a party with two tanks was in a game you were running, and the other tank ended up being blown up by a barrel of gunpowder. It's really unfortunate.
When was this?
How that happened. This was Toby's paladin in Union. When I was playing Neil. Gith EK Eldritch Knight, and yeah, there was an incident. There could normally be one tank.
David, when you say Toby's character got blown up by a barrel of gunpowder, you blew Toby's character up with a barrel of gunpowder, if memory serves.
I think the character was just monster adjacent, and you know, it turns out that area of effect is a thing that happens in life.
But there's a really good example though. Toby played his paladin as a tank. His paladin was a tank. It was a tank paladin. Your Gith what were you, Eldritch Knight, you could tank, but you weren't a tank. You were battlefield control. You used a lot of your time running around and using, frankly, mage hands and firebolts to sort of control combat arenas. Like, there was no control caster in that party, so you fulfilled that role. And that's my point. You fulfill party roles. We will fall into party role dynamic in a combat scenario. Most players will, because we're so used to it. So it makes sense to make a character that will fulfill part of that role neatly and in a fun way. That doesn't mean you have to, but I as a player enjoy playing more when I can look at the rest of the party and go, I fulfilled this role and I'm empowering all of you to fulfill your role.
No, I agree with that entirely. I mean, the way that Aldrin ended up being structured, mainly because of some ridiculous stat rolls when I was building him, there were times when I would have been better mechanically, like looking at the numbers, at rolling for things than the character who was designed to do that.
Yes.
The reason I didn't do that is because it made bugger all sense in the story. And also there's a decent assumption that the person who's built their character to do a thing probably wants to do the thing, right?
I mean, that too. I find it very, very interesting when a player comes in and says, I've rolled these stats, and you go, God, they're amazing. Like, number one, I don't have a problem with that as a player. If you roll stats and go, I want to play that, play it, it's fine. I tend to halve. If I have too many big ones, I halve one. I like having at least one dump stat, ideally two, because it just means that there are things I'm terrible at, and I like playing characters who are terrible at things. It's more fun for me.
I like having characters that are terrible at something. Like, I enjoyed it when you imposed Baishra on me in Frontier, Baishra being the druid with an intelligence of six.
Oh,
I enjoyed that.
Wonderful character.
I can't do it to myself. I've learned how to not entirely optimize. Like, I won't be like, oh, I have to take this feat because plus 0.2 extra damage. I've learned how not to do that, but I just can't, my personality will not allow me to willfully nerf myself. I just can't do it.
The thing with willfully nerfing yourself, and I do think it is something that is a really lovely thing to do when you're playing. Willfully nerfing yourself not only means that you are creating your character's kryptonite, you're creating your character's weak point, you're also creating your character's thing they need help with. And that's really, really important. Like the centaur barbarian I played in Emma's game, where we went to the underworld of Theros, and like, they weren't smart, but I didn't want to play them smart. I had a partner and some friends who were super smart, which meant that if I saw something I didn't like, I'd run at it until someone told me that I shouldn't. And of course, there were times where they didn't have time to tell me that, and I ran at it anyway and took lots of damage or got hurt, or it hurt my friends, and I had to learn the difference there. It doesn't matter that Chris, the player, is there going, I'm about to do something really stupid. It didn't matter, because it meant that it gave everyone impetus to go, no, Danae, don't go there, come over here. And it gave them, I felt that as a storytelling device, it gave us interaction points. I could come to them, and it also meant that afterwards they could come to me if there were things they needed interaction points on the other side. So it gave us this lovely chance to tell stories together, which is for me more interesting than, here is my super powerful everything character.
I absolutely see that. And I don't think, I think I've got a lot better. I don't think any time recently I've played a character as being, I am the super powerful all god of everything. I just like being able to think that if I wanted to.
You started in CRPGs, Dave.
That's true.
You started in CRPGs, and I've played all the CRPGs. I love CRPGs, but you know as well as I do, what do? You max that character out.
Yeah.
You can rely on no one but yourself. You have to be the character that everything. You should be in all the cutscenes because you're the lead. So, of course, you max the character out. You take every single feat or ability that's going to make you, 0.2% more effective, because that's how those games are designed to be played. And there is a school of thought that D&D can be played that way, and I have played it that way, and it's not unfun. Yeah. It's great fun. But when we're trying to tell stories,
it's also coming from the MMO standpoint, because there was a time when I was in played a really high level of World of Warcraft, and basically if you weren't meta, then you better get out of the guild.
I do think that quite a few mamorpigas, or things that require interaction, social interaction online, often fall into that paradox where everyone can interact, so therefore they'll all roleplay so much harder.
Yeah.
No, they'll meta the hell out of it, because you've created a dynamic where those that are the most visibly powerful will rise to the top and everyone will want to emulate them. Like, even something as I don't want to describe Minecraft as banal, but even something as simple as Minecraft, which is a building game. It's Lego. I mean, it's not. The copyright people will have a field day, but it is. I put this block on that block and I make an awesome thing. It's now become this bizarro, you know, war of attrition against what can I possibly do that no one else can do? And it's about putting one block on top of the other, mate. I think you've taken this too far. I think there's an element of that you can fall into with RPGs. And I don't think there's anything wrong with falling into RPGs. It's an easy way to see it. My character can do everything, so I can play every game that gets thrown in my direction. But then my job as a DM, if I'm DMing that character, is to go, where's the kryptonite? Where's the hole? Where's the belief that needs to be worked on? Where's the NPC they can't quite get over? You know, stuff like that.
That's why I try and make my backstory is quite comprehensive, because even if there's no obvious weakness in my stats, I try and put them in there, but you know, it's baby steps.
I mean, I would say that with Aldrin, actually, if we're going to talk about this, I think with Aldrin, what you have done with Aldrin, and I thoroughly appreciate, is yes, you have some ludicrous stats. Your wisdom is a 20, and you've got observance, so your passive perception is 33. We joke about it on stream. It's not bad that your passive perception is 33. It means that nothing escapes the party's notice, which is great. As a DM, I approve of that. You know, in the new it's 4 years old, the current Critical Role campaign, they've got a cleric with a passive perception of 28, I think. And again, exactly. It means that the whole party knows what's going on. And yeah, the DM often has that kind of you, but he clearly likes he can talk about lore more. It's not a bad thing. These are things that come up as part of that, but Aldrin has an intelligence score of 10.
Yeah.
Big metaphysics, large concepts, more than thinking about the day ahead, doesn't cross his play. So presenting him with quandaries that have repercussions over an extended period of time, things where you can look back on choices that you made and go, I should have been smarter then, define that character. And we had it in the last episode. Yeah. You had a literal, hey, I've changed subclasses. I know all about peace and love. And oh God, I want to kill this person and I shouldn't. Which is gorgeous. It's a crisis of confidence. It's a crisis of faith. It's a crisis of everything. And it's a wonderful, tense story playing moment. My God, what's the point?
And suddenly, I think playing with others has made me a more social person for sure. The way that the stories kind of interlink and things, but then when you're playing with people who are so good, you find it easy to know where those beats are and to know when those moments of vulnerability come. At least I've found that almost all the time I know what to do and I know how to do it. And there's been one or two moments, and that case in point was, what do we do with this very dangerous person who, for some reason, after going on a murderous rampage, the party's decided to tie up and be like, I think we should let this one go. It's like, but I want peace.
Dave, it's
because, why?
Dave, it's because they surrendered, mate.
Yeah.
We are bound by Christian mores, and you can fight that all you want, but if someone surrenders, we as people growing up in the societies that we grew up in are probably not going to hurt them. We think it's morally wrong. Do you think I didn't plant that?
If only they'd been asleep, we could have massacred them without mercy.
Well, exactly, because that's not a problem. But,
That's a fair point.
There's a huge amount of... I mean, this is where I would say that if there is a DMing tip I would give, and I don't like giving tips like that. Organize your DM screen properly. No.
That's advice. People can take it or leave it, as it works for them.
Exactly. Knowing how you think your players will react to a scenario and then giving them that exact scenario or taking the mores of the world they come from, our world, and saying, and now we're in a D&D world and I'm giving you this, and watching them go, ooh, if this is in the real world, I would not be able to stomach it, and yet I'm doing it right now. Or conversely, I wish I could do this in the real world. Yeah. That sort of interplay between the character and the player and the world is really fertile ground. You can do a lot with that in terms of characterization and story points, especially if you want your players to roleplay more. Giving them a moral quandary is gold dust, because it will always create questions, they'll make snap judgments they regret or that they love and think, I made the right choice. And then having the world go, it may not have been the right choice, and watching their worldview change or develop or interact differently, that's all wonderful.
Really, don't get me wrong, it was a lovely story moment, but my gosh, it was one of the hardest decisions I've ever had to make in game for as long as I can remember.
And I loved your reaction of we murder people for a living, but this is where you draw the line, is a wonderful, like, but this is D&D, we murder people for a living, what are you talking about? We're going to murder the big bad. Is this person the big bad? Are they not the big bad? We thought they might be one of our friends disguised. I mean, I will tell you now. We're in an interview. This is for you, audience, fans. I will share this with you. The High Priest of Mask, I had a stat block. I used that stat block for 5 different characters that you all encountered throughout the course of the game. Just in case, because that person could have been anyone. And I wanted the feeling that that person could have been anyone. That it may have been your lover and your friend. It may have been that random person you met in the bar over there at one point. Just, I had that stat block ready. And on the rare occasions where those characters needed to make a role of some description, I used that stat block.
Yeah.
Because I wanted the possibility to reveal at the end if I wanted to. But then there was so much going on with other things at that point that making it another reveal at that point wasn't necessary. But it might have been, and I wanted to have that ace up the sleeve, you know?
That's very masky, for sure. I just like to say for anyone that thought it was a sort of vicious murdering, that Dimension Door is a thing and doesn't require certain components, right? So there was a genuine threat. Just throwing that out there.
I don't know if you heard from off screen, Emma very quietly saying that they would have murdered me if it had been Aradine, and that's not unfair. But that's the point. The brutality of that betrayal, if it had been, if there'd been nothing else going on, and if I needed a shock moment that hadn't happened, but that episode luckily had more than enough shock moments in it, it didn't need it. But if I needed a shock moment for a story to sort of like punch home at that point, it was a good one that I had in my back pocket, that I had never failed the right role or done anything wrong. Which meant I could have done, and I didn't want to. Aradine is very, very much a self-insert. But there was a potential there to do it if I wanted to and if I needed to, and I like having aces up the sleeve. I like giving myself those outs if I need to.
Aldrin definitely couldn't have killed Aradine. Like, no way, no how.
But imagine how it would have been, Dave. Imagine that moment when you realize that the High Priest of Mask is your lover and you want to kill them, but you're not going to, but then I don't make them surrender so the party tries to kill them. Then what?
I think it would be very Point Break. Throw your gun in the air and go, "Arr!"
Yeah, but that would have been a fantastic moment. If we didn't have, if for whatever reason the ritual had worked and there was something else going on, or LaRouche had left early because there had been some targeted attack, and LaRouche at that point, I mean, I'm not going to say couldn't have died. Of course they could have died. Players can do what they want. Like, if Jules decides to disintegrate on that day, I can't do anything about it. But I had various sort of plot things that could have happened there. And if they hadn't worked out, it was an option. It was definitely a story option. And it would have made perfect sense. There was nothing I had done that broke any setup that we'd already given it. But I also really liked that there was the possibility of you all going, "But it could be." Yeah. It probably isn't, but it could be.
the only thing certain is uncertainty, and I'm not even certain about that.
Well, chat has pointed out before, and they are correct, and if they say this now, then how prescient of me, but also I think they probably will. I like mind games. I do. I absolutely, as a DM, I adore mind games. I love giving players this sense of, this is the way the plot is going, steering it left field, but then having all the players go, "But they wouldn't have spent all that time on that if there wasn't something in there that's important that we have to know." And there's always going to be stuff like that, you know? There's always going to be, in stories that I tell, things where you go, "I'm sure that something else is going on."
Yeah.
"I'm sure there's a deeper rabbit hole here." Because I like stories and films and TV shows and comic books and all the rest of it where those reveals suddenly make you go, "I have to reevaluate how I watched the first 10 episodes of this. I have to reevaluate how I read the first 20 books of this." I think that, I love that kind of storytelling. When you go back and go, it all makes perfect sense. The problem is when it doesn't make perfect sense, and when you go, this is just retconning to try and impact Game of Thrones. But I think that's the story.
Just forgot about the Iron Fleet.
But that's the storyteller's job, isn't it? To try and fit all those pieces together.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the novelist's job is to get people to turn the page. Storyteller's job is to get people to wait and find out the next thing. Yeah, I remember when I was in drama school, we are not storytellers, we are story sellers. And that was my attempt at a Swedish accent, which I cannot do. We'll put that on the list.
The nice thing about 9/10 of accents is that you know what they sound like. Like, we all know the joke that Welsh ends up sounding like an Indian accent if you're not careful. There's a reason for that, because there are some very similar vowel sounds. So instead of going, I must not sound Indian, why not go, I need to work out where the connections are and then make the Welsh sound better? Honestly, accent work is not rocket science if you find the markers. And you can go into, like, glottal stops and stuff like that, but my goodness me, life is short.
I mean, I'm one of those weird... I don't think I put any technique into it at all. I just sort of learn by doing. Like, I've recorded so many American audiobooks now, and just...
Mimicry and rote is one of the easiest ways to learn accents. Yeah. It's how my Kermit the Frog came from. It's just listening to Kermit the Frog and doing Kermit the Frog.
It's how I learned how to sing in German.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
One day I will serenade you.
I wouldn't sing in German if I were you. As someone, I mean, people don't always know this about me, but yeah, German's my first language. And it is a culture of many wonderful things. Song is not one of them.
Oh, I entirely disagree. You're, of course, entitled to your opinion, but Schubert, oh my goodness, I could...
Yeah, gorgeous, but Dave, Schubert was over 200 years ago, and now we have Umpa bands.
And, Rammstein?
Yeah, who were notoriously excellent at singing. Hey, did you go to that Rammstein gig? Yeah, did you like the music? What music? The special effects were amazing.
At this point, I am almost tempted to roll a dice just for the hell of it, but I'm going to see if I can get all the way through without doing it and just rely on chat.
A literal roll no dice.
Roll no dice.
We need new emotes. I'll let people know.
The dice theater of the mind. What if I rolled? It's a 20.
Our editors will thank you. That dice animation takes them a while, I hear.
We'll see. If there's a massive uproar at the lack of dice animation, then we will know. We will know that we need to rely on that USP until we drive it into the ground.
I'll get an email at 7:30 on Sunday from our mods just going, hey, so chat got angry, and that'll be all that'll be.
Roll, chat, dies. We'll bring it back if it's desperately missed. But
okay. I mean, we're overrunning anyway, mate. We're going to be talking for a while.
Exactly. I mean, sometimes you just get caught up in a conversation, right? One thing I did want to ask you about, because you are someone who I would think of as being a very good DM for new players, having experienced that as a new player myself, indeed walking into a somewhat chaotic mess. Mm-hmm. I just wondered what you would say, and this is one of the questions that comes up a lot. It's always interesting to hear what people have to say. What you would say to a new player who is considering getting into TTRPGs or playing D&D?
First off, thank you. I don't see myself as a good DM for new players. I don't mean that harshly. I'll explain why. I've played too much, and I don't mean that in a bad way. I love what I do, and I enjoy it very much, but I have played too much, and I find sometimes with new players, I make assumptions about what they will know, and then they don't know it. And there are times where I have unwittingly made players feel like they don't know enough. And luckily, those players have always had the ability either to tell me about it afterwards, or it's filtered back, and I've been able to apologize for it, and it's fine. But I think there is a very serious worry in me about new players, because I worry that I'm going to say, oh, just roll that, and they'll go, I don't even know what you're saying, and I'll feel like I've dropped them in the deep end. But speaking of dropping in the deep end, I think that's the only way to play, frankly. Yeah. Like, whatever... There is this myth that, oh, I'm a new player, how do I start playing D&D? Chances are you're going to join someone else's game. And chances are you're going to be invited in by a friend who plays or a friend who DMs. And chances are you will not know what is going on. Chances are you will probably know some of the people intimately and some of them not from Adam, which means you won't know how to pitch things with them either. It's very, very hard to know how all those pieces fit together. And it's also some players are wonderful, engaging, delightful people who you want to spend time with, and some are narky assholes. But you may enjoy playing with the narky assholes more than enjoy playing with the delightful people, because they may suit your playstyle more. There's so many variables to I want to start playing D&D that have nothing to do with you, that for me, I would say the best way to start playing is to walk into any gaming environment without preconceived notions of what will happen or how you will feel or what you want to do. Because all you are doing is setting up all of the pitfalls of that. Mm. I would say, if you've never played before and you're like, how do I play? And your friend says, come and play in my game, my DM's really lovely. Say things like, what do you think I should do? Who's the DM? Hey DM, what character should I play? Because then they will give you something that will tie into the rest of the game. They will give you the sense of the flavor and the tone of what's going on that you won't be able to get until you literally turn up and start playing. The question of what dice do I roll, what does my character do? There are starter classes that are easier, there is no denying that. There are classes that will require a lot less of you than learning a bunch of spells or how they work, which is, you know, there's a reason people suggest fighters for first-time players, and I don't think that's a bad idea. I genuinely think it's a really good way to start playing, because it teaches you the rules of the combat system, which, once you've got that, doesn't matter what class you're playing, you can do anything. I would also say, as a new player, this is not... You are not walking into your own version of Game of Thrones. You're walking into a... I'm trying to think of the cisgendered heteronormative version of this, and I can't. Football night? Going to the pub.
Yeah.
This is going to the pub. It will have a certain amount of... You know, there's an intense... It's an intense moment, and it lasts for 4 hours, and my God, they're role-playing with each other. It's also basically a room full of 6, 5, 7 friends all enjoying each other's company and having a good time, which you've been invited to join in. So the main thing you can do is join in and have fun. If everyone's, you know, throwing peanuts at one player, join in. If everyone's, you know, ragging on the DM for not knowing whose turn it is as initiative, join in. If everyone is building dice pyramids, which, you know, some people think is really a bad thing to do, join in. Like, take part in the social encounter that is the game.
Yeah.
And you will find your feet with absolutely everything else, because it will depend so much on the other people in that room over the best way to be.
You're just giving me a nostalgia trip now back to Super Bowl parties in the pub in my American football days.
See, there we go. That's what I was looking for. A Super Bowl party. I have never been to one, and I have no idea what you do at one. But if you said to me, Chris, come to a Super Bowl party, I'd go, okay, A, am I going to fit into that pub? Because I'm probably going to wear a dress. And B, once I turn up in that pub, I would be going... Okay, so we all watch that screen, and whenever something happens in game that I don't understand, there's a cheer or a boo or whatever. Yep. Now, you can join in the cheering or booing if you're confident enough, or if you don't, just turn to the person next to you, ideally the friend you came with, and say, what does that mean? And invariably, you'll be dragged into what is going on, and you'll be part of it, and you'll be able to, you know, find your way into it and through it. I think that's the best way to handle it. I can't really think of any other way to put it. I think there's a lot said about new time players, which is, make sure the DM's really warming and heartening. I don't know, like, some DMs really are and some really aren't. And frankly, I've played with both and I like them both for very different reasons. But in each case, I was entering a room where people were, you know, wargaming with minis, or I was entering a room where people were, you know, sat around Theatre of the Minding while drinking wine. Like,
yeah.
I know which one I prefer now, but when I was starting out, I didn't know which one I preferred, and I wanted to see what it was all about, you know?
And like any unknown social event, it can be, it's a nervous process. I remember walking into a game store to play Magic the Gathering for the first time, not really having a clue what I was doing back in the day. And it's just about, I totally agree with you, you throw yourself into it. Get immersed and
find the rhythm of the room and then become part of that rhythm. And then if that rhythm means you're making, you know, a fighter where you have 18s in all your stats and constantly murder hobo everything around you, then that's what that game is. And I DM a game for you where it's very murder hobo-y, but we've had so much fun in it over the years that would I say it's my bread and butter? No. Are we all having a whale of a time? Yes. So what does it matter?
There's been so many abortive attempts to try and inject some level of plot.
Oh my god, the A plot. When's it going
to
happen?
We really want to.
Some of you really want to, and some of you really don't. And that pull is what makes that game really fun. For me, anyway.
It's that group synergy, right?
Yeah, but that's what that group is, you know? Like, that group is silly, dumb fun. Like, at one point, Ed wore a dead man's body as a suit to try and pretend to be them to avoid capture by a guard, and guess what? It didn't work. In most other games, we'd have players going, imagine that in a live game, we'd have players going, this is horrible, we can't do this, this is wrong.
Yeah.
They'd be right, it's the wrong environment for that, for me, it's the wrong environment. But for the home game we were doing, and for the amount we were drinking on that day, it made perfect sense.
Yeah.
It was fine.
Eventide should never be streamed.
But that's also what I think that's what the hobby's about, you know. I think a lot is said about how the hobby is about, like, oh, the amazing role player, all this. And yes, it's lovely that is the case. It is more exciting to me that random person over there can go, I really want to see X, or I really want to play in X.
Yeah.
Because they've played in a couple and they go, well, this is right. And they start bringing over people and go, we're going to play again a bit like this. And then people will phase in and out because they want to play or they don't want to play or whatever, which just happens in every D&D group.
Yeah.
There was an old Dragon magazine article, which was one of my favorites, which was like, what kind of player do you have at your table? And it was like, the lore buff. And it had all this list of different kinds of players. And the last one, if it was, sir, not appearing in this game. The person who has always, like, got the babysitter's ill, or my friend's busy, or their character's always pretending their character's there, but not really there. Like, every game group has one of those characters. They just do, because life happens, and that's okay.
It does.
And this whole, like, everyone's got to be super immersed all the time. Yeah, if you've got that kind of group, fantastic. I run a game that I've been running for 3 years-ish. Which is super intense, super immersed, and the world is so lore-heavy. I'm having a wonderful time, but it also means that if someone can't do it, we don't play.
Yeah.
So, you know, we play once or twice a month, and often that twice a month is someone can't make it, then we shouldn't do it. And there's nothing wrong with having a game like that. It's wonderful to have a game like that. I love that game, and I love playing in that game. But it does mean that it's not got that kind of casualness that other games that I run do have, where if someone's not there, they're not there. We're just going to, you know, we're going to do this. We're going to go down a well and fight a whale, you know. But that's the joy of these games, is having that balance point between the two.
That the Eventide campaign truly is the Super Bowl party of D&D settings.
It really is. And there are times when I despair at the juvenile nature of the story and what players are doing, but also I love it for its... Bizarrely, it's a funny one. Like, there aren't many things in my life that are particularly blokey for semi-obvious reasons, but I think that is one of my blokiest things that I do. And I actually quite enjoy how blokey it is.
Mm.
It's a rare sort of enjoyment of that masculine energy, which I tend to sort of try and push away from a little bit. So, yeah.
I guess it's a safe opportunity to kind of explore that side of oneself and to allow that to kind of manifest, surrounded by people who are friends. And something, you know, it's fun to do something different, I find, as well, because I agree with you. There's a certain mindset that we all kind of expect going into that, and it is quite nice release just to be able to kind of morph into that version of oneself and just enjoy the ridiculous antics for a few hours, you know?
And just to power play a little bit and to make little sort of grunty choices and to have a bit of fun with it and accept that we're all doing it and therefore enjoy it more for it. So that is, yeah, it's great.
Exactly. And no one takes it too seriously. No. And everyone enjoys kind of leaning into the parody almost embracing that. And that is, I think you're right, at the core of what the hobby should be. It's about enjoyment.
Yeah, it's about fun. We're here to have fun. All of this is supposed to be fun. If it's not fun, do something about that. Either ask for it to be more your fun or go and find your fun elsewhere.
And chat, if you didn't realise that you were here to have fun, you've now been told, so there's really no excuse. None.
I will say this for our chat. I've been starting to foray into it. I am... By nature, I am not... It's bizarre. I talk on the internet for, 3 to 6 hours a week on average. And yet, I am not a particularly outgoing person.
Mm.
I stumble into chat occasionally and say hello and want to find out what's going on. But our chat are really lovely. I wasn't sure how it would be. And
so many,
really nice.
Lovely people.
Yeah, gorgeous people.
I've enjoyed my forays and my meanderings, but no, genuinely, we're blessed to have such a wonderful bunch of people.
Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely.
And personally, I must have said this till the cows come home, but I'm really, really pleased for the small part that I have to play in things. I enjoy very much.
I think describing it as a small part is putting yourself down.
Well, I mean, one doesn't like to blow one's own trumpet.
Blow one's own small part.
Piccolo player.
It is funny, though, you know. Like, I've said it before, and it is strange about this. Like, I have an anxiety disorder, and I've only recently started taking medication for it and starting to, you know, make it part of my life and balance it in this way. And it has made me more aware of the strangeness that I spend so much of my life in this environment, talking to camera, talking to people over the internet. And I don't think, oh my God, the hundreds, the thousands in some cases people are going to be engaging with this, what are they going to say or think? I don't think about that. And as those who follow me on social media will know, I don't ever say it. I retweet constantly. I retweet everything I want to retweet from company stuff and from people I like, but I very rarely say what I'm thinking. Not much need. Very, very rarely. And it's partly because I don't really see the point in, it feels like oversharing. I don't think of myself as particularly private. I don't think I'm actually that private a person. I think it's more of a, I'm not sure I have anything to add to this, so why would I say anything at all? And it's nice that in this contextuality, like when we set up Roll Together in particular, but it's been a chain through everything that I've done D&D-wise online, diversity is important, and diversity comes in many different shapes and sizes. And one of the things I think I'm proudest of is the diversity of mental health in our players, and the fact that we have an environment where it is safe, where session zeros exist, where we can, as a group, go, I can't handle X, so let's not have it in this game. There was a lovely moment in a recent Gloomfalls where I think it was Evie asked for permission to make a death gory.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, like, it struck me as at a moment, I went, yeah, of course you can. And then I went, oh, hang on. I've said it's fine, but I didn't, hang on, is everyone else okay with it? And it never came up in any session zeros that massive gore was a problem. I'm not a huge fan of, like, over-the-top gore. I have to rein it in a bit compared to what I would do in a home game, but not extravagantly so. But then going, we are a group where a player wants to do something big and gory because they've done something really cool and they want that moment. But they've also gone, I want to check in with everyone about it because I know some people are not okay with it. We've all checked in with each other. We're going ahead. And now it's not even that gory, but enough for us all to go, I feel like my needs and wants are respected. That's really, really cool.
Yeah, absolutely.
We're very lucky. Absolutely. Like we use the TTRPG Safety Toolkit. We've played with Kenna, I'm sure, who co-wrote it, who I know and is fantastic. And stuff like that coming into gaming now and making it a core tenet of what we do has been so rewarding.
Personally, I'm very pleased to be part of you know, the diverse set of people that we have with different brackets. Everybody brings something different to the table, which is great. And you know, I appreciate you saying that from the mental health perspective. It's not always an easy thing to talk about, but it is something that's out there in the public consciousness, and that's a good thing. Long may it continue.
Definitely.
On that note,
mm-hmm.
I think, although I would love to continue talking to you for many, many hours.
We've definitely overrun by at least 20 minutes. Apologies, editors. I mean,
like, it was always going to happen. It did happen. In fairness, I could just talk to you for hours now and hours, and we would run out of things to say. But that means there may be an appetite for us to speak again in the futurore.
Yes, chat. If you want us to ramble at each other again, please let us know.
In fairness, that'll probably be when Chris interviews me.
Good point. I mean, this might be a good indicator that I shouldn't interview you. We should have someone who's going to stick to questions.
Chad, who would your dream interview
be?
Oh,
no, don't. It'll become a popularity contest. We don't need that.
Goodness me, no. There's no popularity contest. Everybody's a winner. Some winners are more winners than other winners, but they don't need to know that. That is, whatever, Animal Farm. That is all about we have time for when we get to this. Is there anything you want to plug? I don't know, Roll Together.
I mean, Roll Together is most of my working life at the moment. There are other things, obviously, but the main one I can shout about is Roll Together. So yeah, I mean, if you're here, you probably watch our shows already. If you don't, I'm sure there'll be links in chat. But we have shows on Mondays, shows on Tuesdays, and we have the show on Saturdays. And we've also, you know, we just started putting together a stream team, which we've got getting some assistance with. Thank heavens from Macca from Check These Out, who's really fantastic. So if you want to find more stuff that is like us, head to twitch.tv/team/rollingtogether. We'll be doing a big formal announcement of that relatively soon, I think. But yeah, we're trying to keep spreading good stories and other people who make good stories as well. Definitely.
Stream team seems like it's something that should have its own jingle. I'm just saying, I know a guy if you need that to happen.
You and your jingles. You
stream
and your jingles.
Team.
Oh god, it's happening.
Anyway, thank you for joining us. If you're still here after that, thank you everyone for joining us and being part of the show. I have been your host, David Shears. And if you would like to see a country and western version of Aldrin singing the Ballad of Baldur's Gate, just let us know in the chat. I'll make it happen. I'll play it on a mandolin. It'll be funny. Oh, don't have to do it on the stream. I can do it. I can do it for the D20 Club.
For the
Patreon. Well, those lucky few. If you enjoyed us, as Chris was saying, we do stream every Saturday from 6 p.m. to 7 p.m. GMT, and stream D&D games on Mondays and Tuesdays. On Mondays, still from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m, we are streaming Gloom Falls on Baldur's Gate as we leap towards our epic conclusione. And on Tuesdays, we are currently streaming, what are we streaming, Chris?
Warriors of Waterdeep, the Anvil of Doomathorn.
We are indeed. And all of our shows, and of course, DM'd by your lovely self.
Yeah, I'm after Gloom Falls, I'm taking a DMing. I'll be DMing Warriors, but then there'll definitely be a DMing break for the next 12 parts.
Hang
on, haven't we already revealed that? Haven't we? Yeah. We have. Emma's DMing the next 12 part. Yes, it's going to be super exciting. I can't wait.
Absolutely the case. Chris DMing Warriors of Waterdeep, and then the amazing Emma, whom we spoke to last week live, is DMing the next 12-parter. So stay tuned for information, teasers, and the like on that basis. Mm-hmm. All of our shows do indeed stream at twitch.tv/rolltogetherRPG, and there's a YouTube link in chat. And don't forget, you can also enjoy as a podcast. Many thanks again to our D20 Club on Patreon, without whom none of the shows would be possible, all of our sponsors and supporters, and once more, signing off, stay classy at the table. See you next time.
I forgot you did that.